Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. I apologize for my hiatus. Thanks to everyone who has checked in by email to see if this podcast is still happening. I have good news. My wife and I bought our first house together, and the delay was somewhat unexpected. I couldn't have predicted how much work it was going to be in transition to move everything into this house and to do the work that it takes to put a house together, especially when there's some renovating to be done. If any of you have been homeowners, I'm sure you understand, but it is our first time, and my wife and I both grew up in apartments, and our son, who's 14, has also moved around a lot and been in apartments, so it was quite a momentous time for us. We were all quite emotional when we got the news that our offer was accepted, and it's been a very big deal for us. So we're finally in this sweet little house. I'm starting to do my work from the new space that was created. I'm out of the garage and into the storage closet. It's a pretty cool space that's been created, and still have all the same gear around me. Have all the musical equipment, and my son has also started taking drum lessons. So it's fun. We've got a nice little space here for ourselves. Anyway, I can go on and on about how sweet this transition has been for us, and but I'm excited about the podcasts I have upcoming. I've got three recorded already, and the one I'm about to share with you today. These took place at the end of last year, so I don't think there's too many major events in the world that have changed the course of our time since then. But just in case, I wanted to give you a heads up. This next guest is someone I was connected to through somebody that I've been working with for the last 3 years. And this conversation is, I think, one of my favorites to date. In 1989, Shelley Stanger Nelson, my next guest, became the first blind registered nurse in the state of Minnesota. You may think, how could someone be a nurse and be blind? But this is really just the tip of the iceberg. She details her life in her new book, Your Story is Your Medicine, A Prescription for Healing in an Imperfect World. And there's so much insight in this book. It's beyond anything I could have expected. It's an amazing read. As someone who's lost her sight in her 20s, she's also been through multiple kidney transplants, a transplanted pancreas, 3 bouts of cancer, and even more shocking details, which I don't want to divulge, but we get into it in our conversation here. It seems like too much for anyone to have had such hard luck in their life, but her perspective and the grace in which she goes through things through these tough times is really the thing that I think we can all glean some wisdom from. Her story is an exploration really of what health is, and an exploration of our true nature as beings on this planet and of this universe and of all of our relationships. It's challenged me in many ways since reading it to look closer at my life and how well I'm dealing with adversity, the inevitable adversity, which we all would love to make go away, but there's only one way to the other side, and that's through it. She's recently started her own school here as well for integrative healing called Ruka Academy, which we get into in the conversation as well here in Minneapolis. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Shelley Stanger Nelson. Dealing with some of the biases that are going on in and around the promotion of health, we'll call it, I think there's some challenges with things that are going on between allopaths, integrative mm-hmm. health people, healers, and I want to kind of get into the person's story a little bit more. And your story is obviously great, so
okay. I've been on both sides of the bed. That's my whole gig. You know.
Yes,
both sides of the bed. I actually did a conference on that. That was the title, From Both Sides of the Bed and Beyond. So I talked about the nurse experience, the patient experience, and the healer spiritual experience. And I did it at the University of Minnesota Women's Heart Conference, 500 doctors and nurses. Mm-hmm. They ate it up. Yeah. And I think what happens, Jeremy, is, you know, I'm credible, right? I have right? So I have all these hats I've worn. So I'm able to bring that integrative place in, and I can talk medicine, and I can talk from a patient, and I can talk from an integrative practitioner. So you can let me know what hat you want me to be in, or I can wear all of them.
I mean, I'd like to hear all of them, to be honest.
Sure. And because, yeah, that makes most sense to me. Yeah.
I mean, and I think the thing that I enjoyed so much about your story is the vulnerability that you really, you know, put out through the entire book. I'm sure there were pieces in there that were, you know, far back and deep. And I was sort of surprised at different points where I thought I kind of had your story down.
But wait, there's more.
And then there's more. So, like, you know, that's why I think your story is important, and why I wanted to talk to you.
So, just out of my own curiosity, can you think of a place where you thought you had me, and then I gave you something that you didn't expect? I'm just curious. Maybe you don't remember right now.
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of places, to be honest. I just got done reading Trevor Noah's book. I don't know if you know who Trevor Noah is.
Mm-hmm.
It had very similar aspects to your book, even though his story is obviously very different, coming from a white parent and a black parent in South Africa in the 80s, which you would think things would have been a little bit better place at that point. But
but
there were times that just floored me with the experience. And with your book, I think I was getting to the point where I sort of understood your, you know, I've worked with diabetics before. I started understanding what was kind of having to happen throughout the course of your treatment. And then when you brought in your, when you were raped, when you were 16 years old.
Yeah.
And really sort of pre everything spinning out of control, it was, I don't know, there was something about it that just shocked me.
Yeah. Yeah. I positioned that purposely in that place. Part of the reason, Jeremy, is because I think this is something that happens in healthcare. We think we have the picture.
Yeah.
And there's something more. And it might not even be happening today, right? But there's always another surprise in there, right? So I put it in there, in that place purposely, because it's my experience that I, as a practitioner and as a patient, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've had the same experience. I
mean, right.
Are you familiar with craniosacral?
Oh, yes.
I figured. You know,
I've been looking for a good practitioner. Do you know one?
He's about 20 minutes from here. Mm-hmm. I've been through so many different layers of the same thing too, where I think, oh, this thing that happened, you know, I've kind of uncovered one layer after another of it. And thinking, you know, I finally feel like I have some resolve to it.
Yeah.
And there's always another aspect of it, or another way in, you know.
Or a whole other, like, what? You know, like, right?
Yeah.
Like a whole other thing that isn't maybe directly related, but is related.
Yeah.
You know, in some way. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Yeah. So those, the interesting thing, talking to my daughter this morning about what I was going, she likes to kind of get a sense of what my day is.
Sometimes. How old is she?
She's six.
Oh, I love
it. So we talk about these things sometimes. And I've actually, my son is 14 and I've had him on the podcast already. So,
oh, have you?
Yeah.
Oh, groovy. I'd love to hear what the six-year-old has to say.
Yeah, well, right? she's a little shyer than he is. He's kind of a stage guy already.
Oh, so. Okay.
But we'll get her out eventually. But she was asking me, I think it started a couple of days ago. I told her that I was going to interview you. And she was looking at the book, and she was very curious to know about what it's like to be blind, and about your eyes. She really wanted to know about your eyes, and what do your eyes look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, now you know.
And now I know. Now I can tell her. We talked about it even from the point of view of sort of we talked about the senses. I thought that was kind of like a good.
Yeah, that's a great way.
A good way to kind of think about what, you know, what kind of things we might experience with different senses.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, she said things like, just, I think she had this sense that Does she like music? And I said, I bet she likes music.
Yeah, because she's going, okay, she would listen more, right? She would hear more. Yeah. So it's interesting because I crochet, and I haven't crocheted in a long, long time. And I picked something up just last week. And I had a friend over today who does a lot of crocheting, and she was helping me with a pattern. And she was looking at the way I hold my work. And she's like, that's the most unique way I've ever seen anybody hold their work. And I'm like, oh, really? I mean, I don't know. I just tell. She says, let me show you the way I hold it. And she's doing these things with my hand and how she wraps the yarn. And all of a sudden she got it. And she goes, oh, this isn't going to work for you. And I said, no, because I need that hand to see with. I need to, you know. She's, oh, she said, I'm using my eyes. You have to feel it. Precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, adaptation. Yeah. I like to tell kids a lot that I see through my hands. And it's interesting, Jeremy, because an important word for me and for my husband too is people will say to me, here, feel this. And it's just, ooh, it just kind of shivers me because I use a totally different sensing mechanism if you want me to feel something than if you want me to look at something through my hands.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that makes
sense.
And
you would get that, right?
And you had something in your book too about adaptation that it's that you kind of believe that it was, you know, that it's that possibility of adaptation is often the key to our happiness.
I said that?
Yeah.
What did I say?
Something very similar to that.
I can't find that right now, Jeremy, but yeah, it's our ability to part of our it was something like a key to our suffering is our inability to accept our circumstances as they are.
Yeah.
And when we are willing to adapt to what is present, instead of demanding, I use that word.
Yeah.
People say, I don't demand. And it's like, oh, really? Let's talk about that, you know? But instead of demanding that it be the way, I wanted it or I want it to be. So,
yeah. And I mean, having gone through, I entered into this field with, I wasn't planning on being in the health field. I was planning to be probably an English teacher or writing teacher.
No, you were
going to
be a rock and roll star. You already told me.
Yes, that too.
Okay, but so an English teacher.
It was clear the rock and roll star wasn't going to happen. I lived out the archetype, and then But the back problem was sort of coinciding with the rock and roll lifestyle.
I did read this on your
And that I got to a point where I wasn't getting any answers from the network of people that I had access to. Mm-hmm. I was also very young at the time, so I think they kind of looked at me and said, "Oh, you'll be fine. Just rest it up." And resting, it wasn't making me better. If anything, it felt sometimes like it was getting worse. And so, that thing that you talked about of just now, and you kind of went into this in more detail in the book, which is that we kind of want to like cut off that part of ourselves, or we don't want to accept this piece of us. In fact, we start to look at it negatively and disassociate from it. And the turning point for you, I felt, in that book was this moment where you suddenly owned this disease that you had been living with and the organs that were replaced.
Yeah. There's so many times, Jeremy, through the course of my whole life about, being able to receive, okay, so getting three organs in my life, taught me a lot about that. And it taught me a lot about my resistance to that or my belief system around what that meant to receive, right? But the idea it came really fully into me, I think, was when I had the cancer. But the biggest point came in for me, Jeremy, was when I was diagnosed with the third type of cancer, the stage 3 aggressive lymphoma.
Yeah.
And I had people, saying to me, I hate the cancer, you know, and the words we use about fighting with it and battling.
Being hostile towards it.
It's all hostility, right? Yeah. And I could feel my own self when I would hear that. And I would be like, huh, you know, it's a little like jarring. And I was in a point of meditation. I talk about it in the book, mm-hmm. right? And I was in this point of meditation. And a spirit just said to me, what is the healing force of the universe? And I said, love. And it just like, love. I need to love this to death. I need to love it to death.
Yeah.
And to accept that it was there, that it was mine and not somebody else's, right? And that my body felt energetically and physically and emotionally and spiritually better when I could shift from anger and hatred, which are real emotions that I did feel, mm-hmm. to compassion and loving. And honestly, my meditations were all about turning my cancer cells into little hearts. That's what I focused on. And I think it totally flies in the face of what most people would even consider doing.
Yeah. And I think this is one thing that I see a lot of biases with. And, you know, and I struggled with this myself, even with the term healer, you know, because... You know, I feel like... We are all healers.
You bet.
We are all healing ourselves.
And what does that mean?
Right. Yeah. And what does that mean? But in terms of what we use for words or what we use for imagery, these are all kinds of hypnosis, really. How are we using these pieces for ourselves? And people get very sort of freaked out by these ideas like hypnosis when we're doing it to ourselves all the time.
Right.
It's just a matter of wording.
Precisely, Jeremy. I mean, we're hypnotizing ourselves constantly, yeah. right? I mean, I'm fat, I'm stupid, I, you know,
yeah, I'm whatever good enough, self, I'm not good enough.
I'm not good enough. I'm too much, you know, all of that. It's yeah. all self, and it is hypnosis, and it's not, you know, sometimes people try to talk to me about, oh, you mean it's mind over matter? No, it's not about mind over matter.
Yeah.
It's about, the amygdala and the limbic brain and the energy system and the levels of the energy system and, you know, all of this stuff. And so I just gave a lecture, actually a public lecture at the Minneapolis Women's Club last week. And I titled that lecture, Things I've Learned About Strife and Life. Lessons from a Nurse, Patient, Healer, an everyday person.
Yeah
because we are everyday people.
Yeah,
we might be doing extraordinary things, but we're everyday people. And one of the things I talked about is how our limiting beliefs, it's what I call it, our limiting beliefs either sabotage us or catapult us.
Yeah
And people don't think about what their beliefs are, though.
Yeah, I actually wrote down a quote related to this from your book that I really liked.
Oh,
and
I wrote something you like. That makes me happy.
and I feel like it just relates to what I've been sort of. I mean, I feel like I'm going through some sort of shift in my own work and my own work with other people, but personally as well. And your quote was, "Are you able to see how your heritage, where you live, and your real life experiences have set you,
up for
exclusionary beliefs and opinions? Are you willing to become transparent and acknowledge these judgments and prejudices?" And there's something about that I think is very important when it comes to both our personal healing mm-hmm. and our social and cultural healing. Mm-hmm. In terms of how we relate to one another.
Right. So in this lecture, in this talk I just gave, I helped people to understand the quote you just brought up. So I spoke about, and when I teach, I talk about, so how do these limiting beliefs even start? And they're very innocent. So I use this example of, you know, you teach your children to protect themselves that strangers are dangerous, mm-hmm. right? That's easy. It's simple. Everybody talks about it, right? And so this is told to us as kids. And then as we mature and age, right, we hit more discernment and we're not as naive and that sort of thing. And we can feel more comfortable in a wider range of people. But then we go, well, like, who's a stranger, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's somebody who's maybe different than us, maybe acts differently, looks, you know, all these factors, yeah. right? And so even though we as adults aren't going, you know, oh, I don't know that person. He, she is scary and bad. There's this limiting belief that's set in our limbic system that says, strangers are dangerous. And then we get the limiting belief that says people different than me are dangerous, right? Yeah. And it plays into our xenophobic nature yeah. and our biases and our bigotry. So on the social level, right, this is important for us to recognize that we're doing this.
Yeah.
On a health, physical health level, let me just talk about that.
Yeah.
Because, so I was on this expedition to become healthier, right?
Yeah.
Physically, like, here was my thing when I started my integrative practice and journey for, well, what am I going to do? I wanted something that actually did something, Jeremy.
Yeah.
Oh, you hear me, right?
Yeah. What do you mean by did something?
I wanted to have better physical health. I wanted pain to go away. I wanted my blood sugars to be better.
Yeah.
I wanted, you know, you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I wasn't, don't help me relax.
Right.
That's not, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I'm on this extensive journey and I, you know, did what I thought were really high level kinds of things to cure diabetes,
yeah.
for example. And it was in my journey that I unveiled that I had a belief system, Jeremy, that said, I'm supposed to be sick.
Mm.
Now feel that.
Yeah.
I was the sick one in our family. It yep. felt normal
yeah, yeah.
to me. To be sick. And when I had that revelation, oh my, it was like I ran into a plate glass window,
oh,
right?
Yeah, I can only imagine.
It was, I thought, how, well, it's impossible. How will I ever become well if my belief says I'm the sick one?
Yeah.
It was the role I took on in my family, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to start unknitting that.
Yeah.
And boy, that's hard and long and deep, especially with my history, right? And it was...
And where do you start?
Oh, exactly. Where do you start? And I could tell you the one thing that I started with me was I stopped talking about my health when people asked me how I was.
Hmm.
Do you see? Because it would be a normal... that. I've had 3 organ transplants, 3 bouts of cancer. I mean, it's long and it's yeah. long and it's yeah. long. And there's a lot of things that can go wrong any given day.
Yeah.
So when people say, how are you doing? They mean, are your organs functioning, right?
Right.
And, you know, and I took the bait. So yeah. I started saying, oh, I'm great. You know, Brent and I are planning a trip.
Yeah.
Where I thought, you know, oh, I found a great new recipe. I thought, who would I be if I didn't have this health thing to talk about?
Yeah.
And then slowly over time, Jeremy, people quit.
Yeah.
Associating sickness with Shelley.
Yeah. I've worked with people who have gone through, I had this one client in particular who had been through 4 bouts of cancer, double mastectomy, other issues and complications as it relates to that, which I'm sure you understand well.
I do.
And they decided upon this course of ongoing chemo, where she would basically do chemo about once a month.
Mm-hmm.
And so every, you know, depending on how our appointment fell, you know, I knew that she could be anywhere in those 4 days post chemo. And, you know, sometimes she can come on those days with the appointment, sometimes not. But she chose not to tell her children mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. She chose not to tell most of her close friends. Her mm-hmm. her husband happened to be a doctor. And she, you know, she just didn't want to be associated
identified
as a cancer survivor all the time. And that you know, that identity that becomes so strong. She said it even gets to the point where she just hated going into the clinic. She started to realize that even the workers at the clinic started to just identify her,
right.
you know, in that way.
It's a natural evolution. Right. And what I had to do, Jeremy, for myself, what I learned was, you know, the only one that was going to change this was me.
Yeah.
You know, so now there's a lot of medical stuff happening with me right now. Mm-hmm. My friends don't even know.
Yeah.
Sometimes my parents don't even know.
Yeah.
Because I don't want that energy floating around in the room and in the universe and coming back toward me.
Yeah.
So that was a huge shift for me. And I myself believe that I saw physical changes that were health promoting that happened because I changed that belief mm-hmm. system and that thought process. Mm-hmm. And what do I mean? I feel like I had more energy.
Yeah.
I feel like I had more optimism. I wasn't in denial. I mean, I knew what was going on.
Right.
You know, and just a more robust feeling in myself.
Yeah. And you kind of get into that in the book, and I really related with my experience just in terms of that energetic part of things. You know, it's very typical, and I've had a few bouts of chronic back pain. I'm pretty far past most of it at this point. I'll have mm-hmm. a tiniest flare up now, mm-hmm. but you know, there were points where I would be, you know, laid up for a month. And you can get into, you know, you go deep inside and you go through a lot of different things in those time periods. And it's pretty typical. And I say, because I work with, you know, quite a few people with chronic back pain or
so you hear kinds of the things, same,
you hear the same mm-hmm. patterns over and over again, mm-hmm. which is that it's depressing to be in that state, to feel like you're not sure whether you're going to get better. And that there is something that I feel like I've learned that's similar to what your technique might be, which is I, you know, it's probably an imagery technique of some sort, but I imagine, I just think about my body as healthy.
Absolutely.
And I can almost like go from having like a lot of lower back and hip pain to believing that I just need to walk right now.
Yes.
And as I start walking, I imagine my body doing it normally, and it yes. just kind of goes away. So
I know, completely concur. Yeah.
And I have techniques, and we learn things and ways to manage that, which are part of that. But I do believe it starts with that idea, that belief system of imagining yourself a certain way.
And I think always, yeah, I concur. And I think always the balance is that line between denial and positivity.
Yes, totally.
No, really.
I agree with you.
Right? Yeah. So, you know, in denial, we refuse to even acknowledge that it's here. For me, in positivity and in a limitless belief system, I'll say something like, well, even though my chronic pain is flaring today, I still have strength and stamina.
Yeah.
Even though X, right?
Yeah.
Y is going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you end up deciding you needed to write this down, your story?
I got cancer.
Yeah.
So in the foreword of the book, I talk about it, but mm-hmm. I'll say it. I got this monumental, huge diagnosis called stage 3 aggressive B-cell lymphoma.
Yeah.
And that's a big diagnosis for anybody. But for somebody with a compromised immune system because of my transplants, it's pretty scary. Mm-hmm. Because cancer is a disease of the immunity.
Yeah.
Right. So was laying in my bed one day, wondering how I was going to fit through this little eye of a needle. And I recollect a conversation I had with a shamanic practitioner about 3 months before that. And this shamanic practitioner, I was having conversation with her about something totally unrelated. And she said, I don't know why, but I'm supposed to tell you that your story is your medicine.
Hmm.
I was like, oh, really? She said, it's time to write your story. And I'd wanted to write a book for a long time. So like I hung up the phone and went, yeah, sure. I can't write a book. I'm busy. I'm working 3 jobs. There's stuff happening to me. Goodbye. I can't write a book.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, then 3 months later, I have this diagnosis and I'm laying and I'm speaking to spirit. I'm like, what am I supposed to do? And I hear, your story is your medicine. It's time to write your story. And that's how I decided to do it. I knew that I needed something to do during the chemotherapy that would be helpful and helpful. So the first manuscript was purely for me. I wrote mm-hmm. it just for me.
Yeah.
And that book was titled The Healing of a Healer. And it was such a catharsis. I was shocked, Jeremy. Mm-hmm. Like you say, layers and layers. I mean, I had done this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Years, money, data, and the stuff just poured out of me. And then when I got to the end of it, and I was pretty much done with chemo, I sat back and I went, you know what? This can help other people.
Yeah.
I have to write it a little differently,
mm-hmm.
but I really took the main thrust of everything I wrote and then just added in the reader-directed inquiries and the kind of the teaching tools into it.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And you and your husband is also involved in the school of healing that mm-hmm. you started.
Yeah,
Ruka.
Well, he's the president.
And how did when did you guys start that project?
So that was born in about 2008 or 2009, and that came because. Two reasons. First of all, I was teaching at a pretty prestigious school, nationwide international school. But I was sick of getting on an airplane mm-hmm. and traveling and teaching and going back and forth. And I also had a lot of my own wisdoms that I wanted to teach. So I was like, I don't want to get on an airplane.
Yeah.
And then I had a lot of students that I had that I was teaching just in my, basement
mm-hmm.
About beliefs and spiritual development and conscious living. And it was really them who said, can't you teach just healing stuff? And I'm like, yeah, I think I could do that.
Yeah.
And so I opened this school, and the school really has evolved as I've evolved. The school is much less now about any particular technique, because that's not what I've learned is the healing.
Yeah.
So the school has really evolved into being able to help people with their spiritual awakening and mm-hmm. their spiritual maturation. And as I call it, living a soul embodied. And then we learn how to transfer that to another person.
And do you find it's difficult sometimes to, as we were talking earlier about bringing the idea of spirit in, or, something like that into the idea of medicine is a real hard one for Westerners. Do you find any difficulty also with different cultural backgrounds and belief systems as it relates to God?
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Yeah. So Jeremy, I've resigned myself to the fact that not everybody will be able to do this, because if your belief system says only Jesus can heal. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to change that in you. Right? So only the people, right, who are going to believe in this are going to come to it. It's interesting because I do an invocation and a prayer, and I teach my students this, right? And so every year when a new cohort starts, the class gets just super fidgety and they go, but what if I have a client and that's not what their belief system right, is, right?
Yeah.
And they go, well, maybe you're not the right practitioner.
and that's difficult.
But why is it difficult?
I mean, it's difficult for some people. I had a teacher one time who said to us, started out the course. It was involved in craniosacral training but more advanced stuff. And he said, so I want you guys all to recognize the fact that doing the work that you're doing, you have codependency issues. Which I thought was kind of a great way to say that.
It's perfect.
You kind of need to be involved in this work and you need to have somebody else on your table to be doing craniosacral therapy.
Hello.
Right.
You need a client. Oh, I see.
But in terms of the work that you need to do, I find to do the work, you have to be doing your own personal work. There has to be that tapping into something that is, you know, you describe it in different ways in the book, whether it's, you know, the divine, God, you know, it's the source. Yeah. It's sort of up to you to sort of define that, but you have to make a decision on how you're defining that, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think the important thing, Jeremy, that you just said is, as a practitioner, you have to be doing your work. And if you're not doing your work, as far as I know, you're not the best practitioner you can be.
Right.
Right. And you're doing a disservice to your client. And there's lots of holistic things out there, Jeremy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where people don't do their personal work. And that's why Ruha focuses on that.
Yeah.
But let me say something about bringing it into medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to push against you a little bit here. Because I've been a nurse for 35 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And work with a lot of doctors, nurses, a lot of people. And what I find today, it's 2017,
mm-hmm.
is that many allopathic doctors are willing to entertain this idea of holistic medicine.
Yeah.
They don't understand it, but most doctors that I know anyway are willing to say, well, I don't understand it, but tell me or teach me or... Yeah, sure. Really, Jeremy, I see way more hostile bias on the other side.
I actually agree, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Because working with this friend of mine for a couple of years, who's a doctor, he was down at Mayo for a while, and they were out at a dinner for somebody who was a colleague who was leaving the clinic, and he started talking about his working with me. And about craniosacral therapy, and like five of the people at the table said, "Oh, I love craniosacral therapy."
No, see, yeah,
you just wouldn't expect that.
Well, you don't, but see, limiting belief, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and I think things are changing now.
Think so
it's
too.
Been around a lot. I know that the medical students that are coming out of, you know, residency and medical school now have courses about. The power of touch and vulnerability mm-hmm. and belief that, no, it wasn't a part of a physician's curriculum 30 or 40 or 50 years, and it wasn't a part of a physician's curriculum 1,000 years ago either, you know?
Yeah.
So we're evolving. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. We're evolving.
Yeah, and I expect it to continue to go that way to some extent. And I felt like one of the things I wanted to kind of get into in the podcast was to kind of deal with some of these biases from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my daughter wouldn't be alive were it not for Western medicine.
Thank you.
Because she had meningitis when she
Amen.
Was 12 days old,
mm-hmm.
you know, bacterial.
Mm-hmm.
So without antibiotics, she wouldn't be around. So
right.
we have to kind of figure out what our places are. And I do think that the dialogue between us all needs to improve. And I feel like that's one of the reasons why I'm doing these conversations in the first place.
Well, I think that's wonderful. And, you know, Ruha Academy has always promoted itself as an integrative school of healing because I'm the owner. Yeah. And I've had 3 organ transplants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So before you diss medicine in front of me, you know, walk a mile in my shoes. I find that most people who are casting aspersions at every medicine and every this and that haven't ever had the need to have that part of their life.
Yeah.
You know, I got in a deep conversation with somebody who said, there's no reason to have fentanyl even on the earth. I said, really? Fentanyl, you know. It's getting a lot of bad press. But, you know, go in and try having, you know, a pacemaker inserted or anything right. else without some conscious sedation. There's a place for fentanyl. It's not in the streets, no. But that 100-100 thinking, I call it. 100-100, right? It's either bad or it's good. Well, most all things are paradoxical.
Yeah. What's the makeup of the people taking your curriculum?
Oh, doctors, nurses, surgeon, psychiatrists, psychotherapists, daycare workers.
Mm.
The thing is that, you know, the curriculum is designed so that people can have a private practice if they want to. But, you know, Jeremy, like you said, we're all healers.
Yeah.
So the content of what I'm teaching about limiting beliefs and, you know, how do I be myself and tolerate the consequences of me, right?
Right.
You can be a healer, right, in your family, in your neighborhood, as a barber, whatever, whatever. I mean, it's transformational, right? Yeah.
And I think when you talked about this a little bit in your book about that idea of sort of, you know, being your most true self, of being able to express that part, and that I've just from 20 years of doing this work, I think I've seen people who, you know, either are limited by their own fears of that expression, or in some way have basically gotten themselves into a place that starts to affect their emotional body and their spirit, which I think it eventually starts to get into our physical selves as well.
Oh, of course it does, right?
And so I imagine that you guys are kind of working in that realm to some extent, right? I mean, this is
absolutely
a realm of teaching that doesn't always quite, you know, we may skim over it in medical school or even in integrative health training for that matter, but to be able to actually spend some time with that and do that self-work is what I feel like a lot of people need to do. It sounds kind of like that's where you guys are in.
Right. And it's where my practice is. You know, I still have a private practice, you know, I see clients individually, but I think, and what happens to Jeremy is that we've become so confused, right, about what's appropriate and what isn't. And, you know what I mean? Like, so the school is about having appropriate emotions to the situation.
Yeah.
It's appropriate to be sad and afraid and angry sometimes.
Yeah.
Versus a lot of times, you know, these spiritual people on the spiritual path. Oh, kumbaya, satnam, love and bliss all the time.
Right.
I'm sorry. That doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm there with you.
Right. Okay. So it's appropriate emotions, appropriate thought processes, appropriate relationships, appropriate ideas and desires. It's about appropriateness. And I think the other thing is, like, when I'm lecturing to medical communities, the physicians want a way to get into the spiritual aspect of a patient's care, but they don't know how. Mm. And they're afraid of crossing this politically correct line, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're a culture, we're a melting pot, right? So then they'll get afraid, the doctors will, of confusing dogma with belief, meaning our thinking, right?
Yeah.
And our faith. this is one of the things I hit a lot on in the book is having faith and having faith in our faith. So part of my work is to teach doctors, well, here's a way in that won't get you sued or fired.
Yeah. And I think you actually hit on something really, I liked this distinction you made between spirit and the soul.
I knew you were going to say that. I'm so psychic.
Yeah.
I just, you know, a lot of study, okay? A lot of study, a lot of thinking, a lot of pondering, a lot of stuff, right? Yeah. So the, and people get that confused, I think, a lot. The soul and the spirit. And
I think for anyone listening, this is a very interesting distinction. So how do you describe the soul?
Yeah. So the soul is the truth of who we are that continues forever and ever and ever and into eternity. It's the essence of God that is uniquely me or you, right? That's right. Your soul. The spirit, I believe, is the fuel.
That energetic part.
That energetic part that ignites the soul. So the soul, I believe, is always there. People say, I lost my soul. No, I think the soul is there. I think what you're saying is you've lost your spirit.
It's been deflated in some way.
Yes, because the spirit has been affected.
Yeah.
So I think the spirit can be transitory and be more robust or less, but the soul is always there.
Yeah, and I see this in people who have either been through an incredible amount of trauma in their life, a lot of physical, you know, I could sort of see that throughout the course of your telling your story. Was a lot of up and down. I mean, it's just, you know, and some of that is that energetic depletion that must go on at different steps of the way. The soul is still there. We're you're still following that thread throughout, but that energetic part kind of goes up and down. And it's a really nice way, at least for me, to sort of
be, well, thank you. Yeah. Well, it helped me too.
Yeah,
see,
good.
that's part of my mission all the time. I'm like, how do I gotta put this in a really clear way. I like clarity for myself, you know, and so. I can remember, you know, way back when I was in Texas and it was all bad. I just said the other night, it was horrible to epic proportion, only worse.
Yeah. I think you said it really well in that it was like, what, 15 months or something you were there, right?
Yeah, what did
it was
I
like
say?
The worst, you referred to it as the decade, something about it being a decade or something.
The 15 months, the decade of 15 months. Yeah.
Because
something, I was very clever with it. I can't remember exactly.
But I'm sure, I mean, it must have been just, you know, it was epic.
It's not describable. It just isn't. You have to do it to even feel it. And at that point, I remember at that time in my consciousness too, thinking, you know, where's my soul? But it was my spirit was deflated. My spirit, there was nothing left.
Yeah.
You know, and I had to rejuvenate my spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you when I'm guessing that you guys deal a lot with intuition and in your work. Can you say anything about the development of that piece? Because I feel like it's a huge part of it's a piece that's lacking in our culture where we're looking for answers. We're searching the internet, looking for all these different things, thinking we're going to find something or different TV shows or the celebrities or whatever it is.
Searching outward for
searching
what comes
outward.
From inward,
right,
I
right.
call it. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. So there are specific exercises that I teach people that I won't, you know, review here because they're detailed.
Can you give us one example of something then?
Well, let me just say this. Let me say this first. So when I'm getting people ready to understand this, I demonstrate to people how in this culture we're predilected toward our reason.
Yeah.
And as energy bodies, there's three functions in us, and it correlates to the brain. And again, I won't give the whole lecture.
Right, yeah.
But we are reason-oriented, we are will-oriented, and we're emotionally-oriented. Everybody is.
Mm-hmm.
And we lean toward one way or the other. And in this culture, we lean a lot towards the thinking and the rational place, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you get right down to it, and I ask people, they always will come to the understanding that the most critical decisions are generally made because they had a feeling about it.
Yeah.
So I go, oh, really, a feeling, right? So we get into that whole, you know, sensing and feeling. So one of the exercises that we start with is just to show people that they can intuit. Have you ever heard of psychometry?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yes.
No? Yeah, yes. Yeah. So we start with psychometry.
Okay.
So we pair up, and for your listeners who don't know, you pair up and you exchange an item that's personal to you. You know, okay, mm-hmm. Not the pen you just picked up in the lobby, but I don't know, a ring or a wallet. I don't know, anything that's personal to you. And you just start, and I just tell people, just say whatever is coming to your mind as you hold this object,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I ask them questions. Is it hot or is it cold? Is it fun or is it sad? Is it, and I give them these choices and they jot this stuff down, and guess what? They know really often. And I say, where did you get that from? And they go, I don't know. It just felt right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when I'm teaching people intuition, the key is you go in. And you go out. You don't linger, because then you start thinking. You say the first thing that comes to your mind.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's as you can imagine, doing subtle work in craniosacral work, where we have to be able to feel the subtleness of the cerebrospinal fluid movement. And this, to a lot of people, this sounds like crazy talk that we can sense something so subtle. But that the body has, as you know, there's kind of a rhythmic nature to the way everything moves. And the fact that we have this cerebrospinal fluid saline tide moving back and forth within our system, to me, only makes sense.
Yeah.
but to trust what you actually feel with your hands and start from that place of not thinking so much, but actually feeling and being in that place that it just feels this way. Eventually it starts to kind of link up with reason on some level too.
Absolutely. I get the knowing, and I go, oh, why do I know this? And then I, all of a sudden the rationale comes in. I'm like, oh, that makes sense. And I think you said an important thing, Jeremy, and that is, the trust piece. And the only way you develop trust in your intuition is to have validation over mm-hmm. and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the plain fact.
It's true.
Right?
Yeah.
The more you go, oh, I was accurate, the more you understand that you can trust it. And we're not always right. And, you know, but neither is medicine.
Yeah. And I think that's why Dr. Eppliger was so big into who kind of coined the term craniosacral, was so into kind of expanding this osteopathic model, excuse me, into starting to dialogue so that on some level we can verify the change that we feel in the body. There are times when you sense someone go a little bit deeper level, that's probably an emotional response. There's an energetic shift that goes on. You can feel it in the fluid. So eventually you start to pick up on all these pieces kind of working together.
All these little cues, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I'm doing too in my work. Yeah. I think too, a thing that's important with health, when we're talking about health, Jeremy, and the cellness, is part. That's why I teach the way I do, because it's I have a course called Living with Consciousness, because part of what we have to do is develop consciousness about what's happening around us. Do you see what I mean?
Oh yeah.
We get really distracted today. And this is why, for me, blindness is a luxury.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not distracted. I asked somebody today, recently, I said, what do you think I'd be most surprised at, having not seen since 1985? And across the board, everybody says, all of the graphics and the advertising. Mm-hmm. And then they told me that, like, pictures of Coca-Cola are superimposed at intersections on the pavement and on the gas handles. I'm like, what? You know, right? So we're bombarded with all this information. But in health and in the work we're talking about here, it's like being able to slow down, be quiet, Turn off all that external stimulation.
Yeah.
And listen, 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 listen. Feel, feel, sense, right? Yeah. Do you work with your eyes closed or open or both?
Both. I mean, they kind of, in my training, too many people were starting to work with their eyes closed to a point where that if you can see subtle changes,
yes, like they were missing it
in breathing, or you know, their eyes opened up, or you know, those could be cues. But I tend to start with my eyes closed, and I almost kind of work with a half eye open thing now, where I'm you know, I have to kind of stay in that, and it's a type of meditative awareness where I have to stay tuned into everything that's going on in the body and kind of shut my brain down in terms of the reason part of my brain, and just be in an awareness of everything that's going on with this person, and in a way kind of shut myself out.
But that's important, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know with like the eyes closed thing, it all depends on why, like when I have a student, it all depends on why their eyes are closed. So I have some people, right, who have a difficult time staying in the physical reality, and so these people, when they close their eyes, it's like, no, you know, because they're going to leave.
Yeah.
And you need to be present.
Yeah. I find that I had a teacher, and when I ended up going to massage school as part of my education to deal with my back. And one of the things.
Don't you love, isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hit this kind of sweet spot where all these teachers had come in from another place. They were part of the school, and there was almost a one-to-one student ratio. So at one point I was just learning something new from somebody all the time. Mm. And one teacher in particular sort of picked up on the fact that I could pick up very subtle things with my hands.
Ah.
And it was a gift I didn't really understand yet, I think. But it was something that I also felt completely natural and comfortable to me.
Right.
So when she kind of suggested that I take this, she was going to take there was a traveling workshop that Upledger was going to be in town, and there were different level courses going on. So I went to take the level one course. And I have to say that I was a little bit thrown off by the ungroundedness of the class.
There you go.
When I first got there, I could feel that some people couldn't stay with themselves. Yeah. And it took me about maybe 3 days in the class to not feel like I was the freak.
I know, right? But see, I've learned that when you feel like you're crazy, you're with crazy people. See, when you know, you go, am I crazy? You go, no, I'm just with crazy people. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And I don't mean to say that they're crazy. But that's part of my important work in the school and with my clients, is like figuring out, okay, why are you not grounded?
Yeah.
Why do you want to leave the physical? Because there's a whole story there too, right?
Yeah,
there's a whole story there. Defense and coping strategies and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you kind of got into this too with the book about the difference between the Anglo-Saxon definition of health and what we've sort of chosen as Western, the Anglo-Saxon meaning being whole. Mm. And that
Halen.
Yeah.
And Halen, the word Halen. Comes from Halen.
And that, you know, I think, you know, we have a hard time sort of understanding what that wholeness looks like. We can have disease and still be healed in a whole way, where we can live in that whole being in our time. And I think that's another very important thing for people to sort of understand.
Right. And I understand, I speak about this in the book too, where initially nothing short of a cure is going to be.
Right, exactly.
You know? Yeah. And that's part of a normal healing process.
Mm-hmm.
Of course I want a cure. Of course I want to see. Of course, you know, I mean that.
And we want an end to fear and sadness and all these things.
And pain and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In the traditional medical field, and again, I think it's changing, but, you know, many people think it's, as I say, absence of disease, you know, is health. But what about, like I said, an appropriate relationship? Mm-hmm. You know, what about appropriate thought processes?
Yeah.
You know, and when we have all that, the disease entity piece itself shifts in a very profound way. That's really real. And again, I get that people want it to just go away, you know?
Yeah. And that the acceptance of self part of this, that relationship is, for me, is the thing that I'm always kind of thinking about as primary.
Mm.
Because I feel like without, and everything is a relationship.
But this is all we have.
Right, right.
Excellent, Jeremy. Oh, I'm so happy to know that you know this. No, it makes me so happy, because that's all we have is relationship. Relationship to myself, relationship to others and all sentient beings, right?
Yeah.
And relationship to a divine entity. And then, okay, so give me something else.
Right.
What else is there?
Yeah.
Nothing, right?
I mean, but even how we relate to our physical world, our physical, you know, our needs, our...
That's what I mean.
The things that we desire, that they're all part of this relationship. But, it, you know, being able to kind of hold that for someone and allow them to kind of, I think, be in that place where they were, you know, and this is one of the things that I feel like I do with, I'm sure you're very similar in this respect, is that this is why I struggle with the idea of myself being a healer or calling myself a healer. If you want to call me a healer, that's another thing. I'm a healer in that I'm working on healing myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that I'm really there as more of a guide, and I'm holding space for people to do their healing work.
Right.
And how well I sort of function as a healer, if that's what you want to call me, is how well I'm able to hold that space.
Exactly.
You know, and guide that process.
Right. Because you can be there doing everything you possibly can do, but if the individual isn't ready, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It'll create the space. And, you know, oh, you said something so important, Jeremy, about, I know what it is. So I teach my students, and I think this is true. Maybe it's true for you. I don't know. But, you know, my healer walks through the door every day as my client.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Every day somebody sits down in front of me and that I'm challenged by something, or I've got transference or this or that or 150 other things.
Yeah,
my healer walks through the door every day in the form of my client.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah.
And it's the beauty of our codependent relationship.
That's
that we
it.
get to have this too. You know, I don't think it's a good or bad thing necessarily. I just think, you know, it is one of the things that we are so drawn to in that respect. And if I look back, and I'm sure, you know, I feel like you were exploring this to some extent. I mean, I'm taking things from your book all the time, but there was so much that I related to in terms of exploring, kind of going back into your younger self and being able to see, you know, where did this come from? What are the threads here from going back to, you know, the child part of me, which is, you know, we're still relating to it. There's a relationship there too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's not about finding blame.
Mm-hmm.
It's about finding reasons for why I am the way I am. And why have I separated from the truth of who I am? And we can always find that early on, you know. When I first read Barbara Brennan's book, Hands of Light, I wrote on the front cover, and there was another student or a teacher at the school, I can't remember, it was his idea, but it said, the purpose of this material is to help me love myself more. And we talk a lot about, this is not who I am, but who I thought I had to be in order to stay safe. And that just holds so much truth for me, right? Because we can get into this negative self-talk or this belief, right? And then we go, well, I'm that, you know, that's just how I am. I mean, I've heard this so many times. Well, that's just how I am. No, it's not how you are,
right?
You are God and love only, you know? But this is who you thought you had to be in order to stay safe. And what does that mean, safe? That means being loved and approved of, period.
Yeah, and you kind of talk about it a little bit. I remember at some point where you're talking about that without being distorted by our ego and probably all these other things, we are just unconditional love, you know, and, mm-hmm. and that becomes distorted through, you know, many different channels and functions in our life, that whether it's, you know, something somebody else wants us to be, or we think somebody else wants mm-hmm. us to be, mm-hmm. or something we think we need to be, mm-hmm. whatever it is,
right?
They keep shifting.
And it happens so innocently, right. Jeremy, you know, I mean, one of our most pervasive wounds on the earth that I think where we separate is this feeling of abandonment or not being good enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, if you took a poll, yeah, right? I mean, everybody would raise their hand going, are you good enough? No, you know? And it starts so innocently. And it starts very, very early. And it has to do with the child sees the mother as God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the child is looking at the mother as God. And you know, you've had children.
Well,
and,
I have a story to tell you after.
Okay, so you're bottle feeding your kids, right?
Yeah.
Or you're not breastfeeding, but you know, you're bottle feeding or mother. And where is the child looking when you're feeding the baby? Right in your eyeballs.
Into your eyes, yeah.
Yeah, they're not like looking over to the side. They're staring right.
Yeah.
And they're drinking in. They're drinking in. Inside of their consciousness, they're going, reflect me. Reflect who am I, right? Mm-hmm. But mom or dad have two or three other kids, right?
Right.
And we're like going, don't put your hands in the toilet. You know, wait, you know, right? And we're stirring the pot and we're doing a ton of other things, right?
Yeah.
And so the internal message to the child is, I'm not good enough. It's what they feel.
Yeah.
Now, nobody's abandoning them and leaving them crying in the crib, but bam, it's done. It's already happened. It's over.
Yeah.
And there you have it.
And you have these multiple little things that we probably continue to process throughout our adult years that are, you know, we can only do our best as parents.
We're born to imperfect people. Yeah, we're born to people who are imperfect. And that's the total truth of it. Yep.
But to what you were saying earlier, too, the thing that struck me was, our son is about 6 feet tall now. And he's 14. A couple weeks ago, my wife was telling me that he said to her, because he's now, you know, a few inches taller than mom, that I'm not afraid of you anymore, mom. And she didn't react at all. But didn't she? No, she.
Oh, that's hilarious. I love her reaction. Yeah.
And she just told me later, that she got it, that it's like you were saying, we are gods to them.
Yeah.
And I've been very aware, even when he was smaller, I've been aware of, I'm over 6 feet tall, I must seem so large to them as children and just
a giant,
powerful being that, you know, that they admire and look up to, but that I'm sure on some level they fear too.
Well, of course, because we fear the revocation of love, because to us, it's like that, as children, that love is what we believe is keeping us alive. Mm. You know, my God, if they don't love me, then, I will. And then that, you know, when we don't heal that, we come into adulthood thinking, I must be loved by all people. Mm. Right? So that's another hole.
Yeah.
Another hole.
Hmm. Oh, that's a deep one.
Yeah, it is deep. Yeah. So I think, you know, health is complicated. And I think the biggest message that I would love your listeners to get is that everything has a place and a purpose. Antibiotics, mm-hmm. you know, craniosacral, energy work, homeopathy. Why have to say either or? That's why I like the term integrative. You know, let's have both and.
Yeah.
And don't be afraid of medicine. I know people who are afraid to take an Advil. I'm like, what do you think is going to happen with an Advil? Oh, you know, the liver. And I'm like, well, first of all, it's the kidney. You know, they always are worried.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but let's just take any pill. Oh, my liver.
They're not afraid to drink, you know, 4 glasses of wine. No, but they're afraid of that Advil.
But they're afraid of the Advil. And I'm like, but, you know, your liver is supposed to detox. That is what it's for, you know, mm-hmm. it can detoxify medicine. Really, it can, yeah. you know, does it have a limit? Sure. It has a limit on alcohol too. Right. right. Yeah. But, yeah.
But, and I feel the same way. I've always been more of an and person. And with these things though, I think also don't be, you know, if you don't have the best experience with the, if you're trying something new, you know, it's all about finding that relationship. Just like you try to find friendships, you know, you have to kind of do the work of trying different things out, trying different people out, getting some sense. I mean, everyone's going to sort of approach you in this relationship in different ways. And you and I were introduced by someone who we both just have a good relationship.
Right. right. We click. We work together. Right. And yeah.
So it made sense that you and I would probably have the same experience.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, I do this when I take on a new client. I do a 15-minute free consultation over the phone mm-hmm. because I want to know if we're going to jive.
I do the same.
Great. Right. Because I'm not going to be of service, right? If I don't jive with the person, me, it's certainly not going to work. The other person might think I'm just fine, you know,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But I've turned down clients saying, I just don't think I'm the right person for you. And that's all I say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes I have a lead, you know, sometimes I just have a real sense of what I think would work better for them. And that's part of it. And sometimes I can just tell sort of where they're at in their process. I might not be the best person for them, you know, whether it's that it's something beyond my scope or something that's just, I don't have a lot of familiarity with it, but I might know somebody who actually really does.
Sure. Referring on is important.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, managing the client's expectations, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So I always on my intake say, you know, what do you hope to gain from our time together? And if they go, you know, I'm going to be healed of everything. You know, I had a client, somebody, it wasn't my client. It was somebody who she wrote me and she said, I want to come in and I want you to do a scan and tell me what's wrong with me. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I laugh. It's always the scan. I'm like, okay, that's not how I work, you know. So I know this isn't going to work. She's not going to get what she wants. I mean, could I sit down and read her energy field? Sure, but that's not how I work.
I've had a similar experience with that too. I mean,
yeah.
I had some very high profile person come in who I know they were being told over and over again things from someone.
Yeah.
And
about their result.
And she got
you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I'd treated her about three times and she said to me the third time at the end of the session, "So what do you think?" And
I feel your pain. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, I kind of explained to her that, you know, this part of this process and this work is for her to kind of start working on the stuff that she's getting, through the work. And I said, so I turned it and I said, what do you think? Yeah.
Darn straight.
And, you know, I've had people who've pushed me in that way. And I know that if you start to give people, you know, their answers, you also take away their power.
100%. So, people will often say to me, "I know you know the answer. Why don't you just tell me?" And I go, "Because I want you to find the goal. It's going to be so much. If I say to you, Jeremy, man, you are really magnificent, you're not going to internalize that until you find that you're magnificent on
exactly.
your own.
That'll just be for my ego.
Right. And there'll probably be something inside of you going, yeah, well, she doesn't know that I, right? You
right,
know,
exactly.
Boy, have I fooled her, yeah. right? Right? Because we're not always magnificent, yeah. right? We make mistakes. So just managing that expectation of clients and really helping people to be empowered so that they, I always say to people, if you have to see me for 5 years, you know,
yeah.
and the same thing, I'm not doing my job because I want to empower you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of think of it at a, in the beginning, I kind of think about it as more of a hand-holding process.
You know, absolutely.
They may be in that.
Oh, we're so aligned, aren't we? Yeah.
They may be in that place where they are sort of energetically weak.
Yeah, they're fragile initially. Yeah.
And then eventually, like very soon, I start to kind of get into really getting them to understand what their intention is being with me in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't answer that, then that becomes, you know, one of the questions there, one of the things that we're really exploring is, you know, what are what are we working on? You know, I think that starting to kind of forward look a little bit more and start to build that visualization piece. Or you had some great thing that you said in there about when you were I think it was maybe when you were in Texas, the rough period, where you sometimes you just have to come up with a purpose for the day, even if they're, you kind of have to make it up sometimes just to kind of get the ball rolling. And, you know, if it's somebody who has struggled with something physically and they've always wanted to get back to, you know, cycling or something, that becomes, you know, one goal. And it can be just something to focus on to kind of move things forward a little bit.
For right now. Yeah. You remember what I did for the purpose of the day when I first lost my sight?
No, I can't remember.
I did two things every single day. I took all the clothes out of my dresser, threw them on my bed, and I folded them again.
Yeah.
No, this is how bad it was.
Yeah.
I was so isolated, and I couldn't do anything because I was losing my sight, and I didn't know how to be a blind person yet. Yeah. Yeah. So I folded and refolded, and the clothing and then I put pennies and nickels and quarters into rolls.
Oh yeah, that's
got them all done and emptied them out and started over again. Uh huh. But you know what, Jeremy? It kept me from going insane.
Right.
It kept me from chewing off my arm from the isolation and the illness and the weakness, you know? And I started. And then I went on from there. But I had to do something. I had to get off the couch. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And that's a thing that I think a lot of people are hitting at a certain point when a real struggle comes, is just starting with step one. That step one is always the important step. And
most important step is step one.
Yeah. And I think we serve as part of the guides through that time period a lot of times for people. Mm-hmm. And I think we are just in healthcare in general, those, like I said, you know, with my experience, it's I haven't been someone who's had a tendency towards depression, but when you hit those points where you're deflated energy period, it's really hard to think, okay, what's that first step look like?
Yeah, because I find that people are looking way too far down the road.
Yeah.
You know, how cycling again?
Yeah.
You know, I have no idea how to do that when I, right?
Right.
Okay, but can you put quarters in a roll? You know, I mean, it's something.
Yep.
And eventually you end up a lot, you know, down the road. Yeah. It's hard for people to accept that that's the limit that they have, though. But once they take a first step, most people want to keep going.
Yeah. And it's just that little bit of momentum. I think we sometimes, you know, this idea that you were talking about before about the cure, you know, you think that you want everything to go away. And so it seems insurmountable when you first start. But really, if you looked at what your day would look like if you felt 10% better than you feel today,
right,
that little momentum, you know, you add another 5% a week from now, and suddenly you start to kind of, it's like the light changes a little bit in your life. You kind of, the way you perceive things opens up just a little bit more, and you might see something that you didn't see before that actually gives you something else. And it, a lot of times I find it just doesn't take very long. It can be a matter of a couple of weeks with somebody if they can really kind of just focus on the rolls of quarters.
Focus on the rolls of quarters. That's a great little catchphrase. You know, and this is how medicine works too, really. You know, they have, and this is how nursing care works. You have a long-term goal, and then you have your interventions and your short-term goals about how you're going to get there. And so it's a great parallel as we're talking about integration. This is how medicine works. You know, we slowly, you know, get to the big goal. Yeah.
What do you think the big goal is for most people when you're working with them? Do you think it's, you have a few things that you kind of lock into in the book?
Yeah. I think that most people start with me with wanting resolution of whatever their symptom is. And very quickly, people understand that their biggest healing is going to be their self-healing and this way they've separated themselves from source. It happens every time for me anyway, Jeremy, you know, and that solves so much pain and suffering. And the other thing it gives people is resolve to be able to, I have a student who went through the program. She's a healer. She had to have her hip replaced. And she said to me once, she said, during the hip replacement, she said, Shelley, I never would have understood that figuring out how I've separated from God and source would help me deal with a hip replacement. But it does. Because she said, in the past, I would have whined and complained about it, but now I figured out why I whine and complain and I don't have to do that anymore. Or I would have thought this, or I would have said this, or I wouldn't have asked for the help I need because surely nobody wants to help me. That's a limiting belief, right? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And because I think for people who are maybe more agnostic listening to this and may have trouble with the idea of God, but maybe they are, you know, people doing good work in the world and who want to see something more connected in life in general. I think a lot of times it starts with this passion they have for that thing that they want to see improve. Mm-hmm. And it could be, sometimes it's external, as we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And so they've lost that sense of the internal. And I think to make it more tangible for someone who hasn't maybe had that sense of whatever they want to call that divinity, their God, it has to kind of connect back to that thing, as your student was saying, you know, that is what's coming up from the source that can allow us to heal and make us feel, you know, like safe in that process, even though there's pain and suffering.
So the human energy field is comprised of divine levels of the field and physical levels of the field. It's there. And so in my work, it's about helping people to understand. We're talking about agnosticism.
Yeah.
How'd you get there? And I'm going to tell you, there's just about always an answer for how they got there, right? And we don't dive onto that immediately,
right?
But we start with, you know, the teeny little tiny first step.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, people are going, wow, there was a half of me missing and I didn't even realize it.
And the ego gets involved. So
100%.
We think about it as our own power, right?
Yeah.
And so then that also means it's all our responsibility at the same time. And and I think that's the where the fear comes in. And, you know, then it's suddenly like, well, maybe I can't hold on to this for very long.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and I think one thing that helped me a lot with the whole divine will or divine mind and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I used to think of divine will as something external to me. Some other thing.
Yeah.
Because that's sort of the Newtonian way of looking at stuff, right?
Yeah.
When I understood that divine will is in my energy field, that it's my, not yours, but my divine will, that shifted, you know, my divine authority shifted that whole idea of something external to me imposing its will upon me.
Yeah. Because then you're powerless.
Right. Or I'm a victim.
Or you're a victim.
Right. Or I'm captured.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's a huge cultural thing in general, and in terms of our, of the medicine that, you know, back to your point about what's going on in medicine and some of our biases, some of those biases have come from the fact that we are looking for someone to, what's the word I'm looking for? There's this sense that we need someone to fix us.
Yes.
And so we don't have any will in that equation.
Mm-hmm. And guess what part of us wants somebody to fix us? The adult self or the child?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Oh, hello. This is my child place. You know, somebody else has to help me.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then what we, you know, think of the power.
Yeah.
When we can help once we can help ourselves.
Yeah. That's the way I tend to think of what evolving is. Is that, you know, that child self is something that we can still connect back to, but if it's ruling our decision making process, mm-hmm. or just limiting us in the way that we're kind of moving through the world, then there's a process of a lack of evolution happening in our lives.
I can say that most people, not everybody, I haven't interviewed the world. Not quite. I'll get on it tomorrow. I'll finish. But most of the people that I've worked with, Jeremy, who have an agnostic point of view, have had a very, very critical parent. Or they've had a parent that was not present. Somehow there was a betrayal of the parent in a profound way.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because they're equating the parent.
Like we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. Mm-hmm. And that therein lies the power loss.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Hmm. Well, thank you so much. This has been really, really interesting. Nice time to get to spend with you.
Oh, good. Thank
you. And I really loved your book, and I think it's something that I like the fact that you being medical, sometimes we can get a little bit too caught up in our language. I feel like you really went through the process of some of what you went through, but keeping it simple enough that I think people can really connect to what, you know, those things must have been like for you. But like I said, I connected with so many things. Maybe on that more kind of soulful level, spiritual level of what that process must have been like. We can only kind of imagine what other people's experience has been, but I think it's important. I mean, to share it, to be as vulnerable as you were in writing this. Mm-hmm. And I
thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you for seeing me that way. Thank you for recognizing that. Yeah. Have we mentioned the book? Should we say it again?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Your Story is Your Medicine, A Prescription for Healing in an Imperfect World by Shelley Stanger Nelson.
Yeah. And I'll put a link to it on the podcast as well.
Oh, thanks. So
if people want to check it out.
You know, thanks for that feedback too. You know, as an educator, a nurse educator, I'm really used to, and a teacher, I'm really used to explaining things in a way that, I like to break it down. Because I need that when I'm trying to learn something. So, you know, make little pieces that I can, okay, I understand that. And now I understand that. Mm-hmm. Now, and eventually we get there. So thanks. It's a complicated, you know, my medical history is very complicated. So I appreciate that you were able to chew it up. And
it's probably going to blow away the average reader, by the way. It's you know, I think the ups and downs and things that you've been through, it's inevitable that people are going to hear this and listen to it and read it and think, this is just beyond what I can imagine.
Well, it's funny because at the last interview or the last public event I did, I had a little piece in the talk, and a girlfriend of mine a long time ago, before half of what's even happened to me, she was taking a creative writing class, and she put me in the book and she described me as I truly am. And the professor in the class said, "This is a completely unbelievable character. This is, you've gone way too much embellishment. Nobody will ever believe it." You know, and it was just the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, you know, I like to say I'm in pretty good shape for the shape I'm in.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to see that.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Shelley.
Yeah, you're welcome, Jeremy. Thank you for the chance.
Wow, how's that for conversation? I had a feeling it could go there, but it ended up going even deeper than I imagined. So grateful for the opportunity to spend time with Shelley in this way, and I can't recommend her book enough. I'm getting so much from these podcasts so far, and I hope you are too. I'm aiming for quality over quantity. I know it's been a little while since I put anything out, and last year we had a little over one a month, but we're hoping to push things forward a little bit more this second year, as we are also building the Highway to Health blog and website. It's going to be a pretty amazing resource site where you can search topics from lots of different people around the world of health, some of them guests, some of them people I know who are just writing very thought-provoking things as it relates to who we are as individuals living together on this planet and about our relationship to each other and how it relates to our daily well-being. You can go to our Patreon page if you'd like to contribute. It's patreon.com/highwaytohealth. Looking forward to spending a little more time with you this year, and looking forward to the spring weather. The light's starting to change. It's lovely. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.